Welcome to Enjoy Exceptional Living. I am Lynn Fritz, your program producer and host. This program is in collaboration with Enjoy Magazine, KKRN 88.5 FM Community Radio, and myself. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. In each of our programs, our intention is to bring to our listeners the best of people, places, and projects of Northern California that we think you're going to enjoy and that we think are exceptional. Today we have a very unique guest on our program. I'm excited for us to have a conversation about a special event that is transpiring in Redding, California. It is centered and hosted at the beautiful historic Cascade Theater in downtown Redding, which is a 1935 Art Deco Performing Arts Center that hosts concerts, community events, and special presentations like we have with this special presentation. You won't believe the title. It's called The Psychology of Serial Killers, and we are deeply grateful to have the presence and wisdom of Dr. Rachel Tolles, who's a psychologist and is nationally and internationally known for her work in dealing with serial killers. Amazing topic. I know this, I would call this presentation a gripping live true crime event that delves deep into one of the most, you might say, disturbing and fascinating subjects of our times. Dr. Tolles is a forensic psychologist. She specializes in extreme violence, serial homicide, and threat pathways. Her work focuses on the assessment and interpretation of these high-risk behaviors, and also, which I think is fascinating, includes the warning patterns that can surface long before a violence transpires. So I want to welcome you to the program, Dr. Rachel Tolles. Good to have you.
Well, thank you for having me. This is such a pleasure, and I can't wait to see the Cascade Theater. 1935, it makes me wonder if it's perhaps haunted.
That's a good question. You know, I've never thought about that, but it is stunningly beautiful. So you have to be sure when you're here at the Cascade, you know, you look at all the beautiful artistry. Yeah, they have to give you a few minutes just to do that.
These old theaters that I perform in are the best. I mean, bar none across the country, and I cannot wait to see this one. But every time I enter a theater that's, you know, from the 20s or the 30s, one of the first things I ask is this place haunted? And almost, I'd say 95% of the time, they say yes. So I have a feeling there are going to be stories about the Cascade Theater, so I'm excited to hear those.
The historic place where I have my office in downtown Redding is supposedly haunted, though I've never experienced any ghosts myself. But I also want to give you a heads up, when you are in the city of Redding, you want to be sure and take in the Sundial Bridge. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Have you ever heard of it?
I have never heard of it.
Santiago Calatrava, a world-renowned architect, sculptor, and engineer, created it, and it was dedicated and gifted to the community through the work of the McConnell Foundation, and it spans the Sacramento River. It's a pedestrian bridge, and it has a translucent glass deck so that the sunlight can still go down to the river and not impact the salmon habitat area in a negative way. Yes, you have to be sure and get a tour of that. And then our listeners, you know, maybe someone's tuned in that's never been to Redding. There's a couple of reasons to come to Redding, just itself, the Cascade Theater and the Sundial Bridge.
It's breathtaking.
Yes, it is. And we have the beautiful Sacramento River that goes right through the heart of Redding. So it's beautiful. You will enjoy it. I wanted to ask you too. You're a psychologist, so tell us a little bit about your educational background.
Sure. So, you know, my educational background might be a little bit different, but I do think everyone who winds up in my field kind of has a story that, you know, most people didn't really know that this is what they were going to be doing. I, you know, very early age, when I was a kid, I witnessed the death of a young girl, and I became quite fixated on the idea of death. And so, and I didn't really ever at that point, of course, I was only 5 years old, so I didn't know that there was a thing called psychology, but I knew that there were people who killed people. And I knew that that was a thing in the world. And it always frightened me, but also really intrigued me how a person could get to that point, even at that age. So I would be writing these stories about it. And I always thought that maybe my work, because I am a writer, would wind up, I originally thought I was going to be a professor who got my PhD in English, and I would teach Freudian interpretation of Russian literature, because the dynamics of human beings has always been what has fascinated me, the light and the dark, and how we wind up on one side of the spectrum versus the other. Like, how do we cross the line into these darker realms? And so that fascinated me. And so, I knew, then when I was 14 years old, I took a psychology class in high school, and it was incredible because I was shown the movie Sybil, and there were things people I'd been exposed to in my youth that really reminded me of Sybil and her case, which is a story about a woman who has severe trauma in her history and develops what at the time they diagnosed as multiple personality disorder, which has an interesting history in and of itself. But anyway, I was drawn to people who were mentally disturbed because, again, I was frightened by it. And I also was intrigued by how does a person get like that?
Yeah.
And then around the same age, I learned about Jeffrey Dahmer. And that, because at the time when Jeffrey Dahmer, his story broke, I was living in Minneapolis at the time. So that was not far from Milwaukee, which is where the crimes where he was caught. And the image on the news of that blue drum scared me to no end. Because we all knew what was probably going on inside of there, because we were hearing about these body parts getting removed. And so I knew that I was very drawn to figuring out how does a person become like that? Because this is a guy who then you're wondering, I mean, what does this monster look like? And then you see him and it's like, he looks like Boo Radley. And he looks like a harmless guy. Like, what is with this person? And so, again, frightened but intrigued at the same time. So then, even though I went to college initially, I was taking both psychology classes and English classes because I thought double majoring. I was always a bit afraid that if I got into psychology, I wouldn't be able to fully separate myself emotionally from my patients, because I was highly sensitive and I consider myself pretty empathic. And I just thought, my gosh, how am I going to not take this stuff home? And how am I going to keep that separate? But then after undergrad, I started working at this place called the Century Regional Detention Facility, which is one of the maximum security facilities for women killers and women who are considered the most dangerous and mentally disturbed. And I was there for a couple of years, and it was the most profound experience of my life. And
wow.
I've never been more. Gratitude is what I've learned, because you see all of these women. Yes, some of them murder their whole families, and
wow.
Some of them been, had schizophrenia, for most of their lives, abuse, victims of the system, homeless most of their lives, no emergency contact, HIV positive, bunch of children, maybe they don't even know the names of. And, and these women are all kind of lumped together, and they're sat at tables where, they're handcuffed to these tables. And, the legal system doesn't really differentiate between people who murder their whole families and people who have been, have these other disturbances that, they're terrified of life. And so just sitting with these women day after day, again, the gratitude, I was like, my God, how did these women, all of these women get in this position?
Yeah.
And how do I, somehow convince these women that maybe, taking your own life is not, because a lot of them are very, high suicide risk, because they're kind of like, what am I living for? And so my job in many ways was to try to uplift. Suicide was not a great answer. So after that, I entered grad school. And soon after grad school, I started working with a supervisor who was in forensic work. And so even though in grad school, I knew I really wanted to understand family systems. So this is where my education is a bit different than some of the people who are just immediately go right into forensics. I was studying hardcore family systems, because to me, it's like, if we're going to understand these people, we really have to understand what's going on at the beginning, because none of this comes out of a vacuum.
I mean,
people think, some people are just born this way. It's like, okay, what makes more sense to you? Does it really make sense that some people are just born this way? If that's the case, then why don't all serial killers have serial killer children? They don't.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
It's like, obviously things have gone very, very wrong. And so for me, it's like, we have to get to the bottom of family systems and systems in general and what's going on here. So I knew I needed to first study that, like the roots, before I got into the forensic territory, because I also knew that we had people like Herbie Cleckley and Robert Hare who were very, you know, their ideas of psychopathy were pretty clear cut. Like, some people are just psychopathic, and there was a level of disdain that certainly Robert Hare seems to have when I read his book Without Conscience. Yes, that's the title. It just feels very much like, wow, there's a lot of disdain for certain people. And I totally understand how you could feel infuriated by people who murder. And this is where I think what I'm going to keep circling the drain throughout my career is that people often conflate the idea of excuse with explanation, and they shouldn't, because for one, there is no excuse for violent behavior ever. Like, you just, there's no excuse for that. People who do these things should be voted off the island, and they should be put in maximum security facilities to keep other people safe. No question. However, we should also get to a place where we can explain how they got there in order to prevent. Because if you just label these people psychopathic, that's not useful to anyone, because now you're just putting them in a category of subhuman. You're not even human, really. You're just one of those things. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I knew, okay, we gotta still humanize these people while understanding. So that's kind of, you know, and then, you know, I continued the forensic work. And then after grad school, I was in private practice for a long time, but really delving into the research and doing my own stuff when it came to studying these people.
You know, a couple things come up when you're talking about this. Do you have a sense, in all the years you've worked with this population, have you seen much turnaround, or does it feel like it's not possible?
Well, this is a great question, because, yes, I've spoken to many male serial killers at this point, and one fascinating thing is they're all horses of a different color. I mean, really different depending on who they are. So you will talk to some. I know I mentioned earlier before we started this that, you know, Randall Woodfield, who is one of your guys, the I-5 killer, who I've had brief exchanges with, he was very quick to kind of almost seemingly put me in an objectified place of like, okay, you're a female, so send me your photos and send me your personal number, versus just,
wow,
like, it was very, it automatically went to that place. Whereas, you know, there are other ones who are not only repentant, and a lot of the ones that, like, there's a guy named Wayne Ford who, he killed maybe four women, and he, after the fourth murder, turned himself in because he knew something is obviously very wrong with me. He was a trucker. And he turned himself in. He had a severed breast in his pocket. And he said, look,
wow,
something's very wrong with my... He had a pretty severe brain injury along with other things. Like, they, all serial killers have these nine factors, which I talk about in the show. But, like, yeah, one of them is severe brain injury. And so, but he knew. And I've had deep conversations with him. And he's repentant. He doesn't feel like he should be out. But he really is like, yes, and he talks about his childhood, the fact that he was beaten by his older sibling at age one, almost to death with a wooden coat, with a wooden hanger, and just how, like, these things kind of happen. But it's not like he's not saying, oh, poor me. He's really saying, yeah, because I'm the one that pries. I'm like, please tell me every detail you can remember about your childhood. They're not the ones saying, oh, poor me, because a lot of times they'll say, I had a fine childhood. And so anyway, but yeah, to answer your question, it's a full spectrum. So, and some people still very much adamantly deny that they've done any of it, even though they might have 18 murders that they were very strongly linked to through DNA and other things. They're like, I didn't do this. So then those conversations are kind of interesting, because then sometimes you'll get a slip up where then they'll kind of start bragging about a murder. It's like,
wow,
didn't you just say you didn't do any of these? So it just depends. But I will say this, these are all human beings. Again, there's no excusing what they've done, but clearly things have gone terribly wrong.
Yes.
And when I think about these people, and when I've spoken to these people, all I keep thinking is like, I'm lucky because I, you know, any one of us, had we had the wrong circumstances, could have potentially become one of these people. And if we have no desire to kill, which most of us thankfully don't, we're really lucky. And that's really what I'm trying to point out is there, but for the grace of God, go I.
Yes.
You know, we don't know. And so that's really one of the messages that I come back to.
This is a segment of Enjoy Exceptional Living. I am Lynn Fritz, your program producer and host. Our guest today is Dr. Rachel Tolles, psychologist who is speaking on the topic at the Cascade Theater of The Psychology of Serial Killers. You know, it's stunning. You mentioned the I-5 killer, which is the Randall Whitfield. He killed a double murder in Mountain Gate, California, which is just adjacent to Redding, California. Will you be talking about that at your presentation at the Cascade Theater?
Yes. So excellent. I tend to just, so there's a live Q&A. The first part of the show is going to be my lecture, which is the same lecture I give through all the cities I go to. And that is mainly talking about, for lack of a better term, the Fab Five, you know, the main serial killer. Everybody thinks about when they think about serial killers, it's like Dahmer, Gacy, you know, Ramirez. Ramirez isn't really in the, but you've got the main guys, you know.
Yes.
Who, and Eileen Wuornos, who people think about, Bundy. Those are the main ones that are kind of in their lecture. And then the second part of the show is a live Q&A where they get to ask their burning questions.
Oh.
And then we also have a meet and greet if people want to meet me. There's like an option where they can scan a QR code and pay a little extra, and then they get to meet me and ask their own burning question that maybe they don't want to ask in front of a bunch of people. So yeah, but usually I prepare to make sure that when I enter a city that I know that they're going to likely want to hear about their local guy, whoever it is, or sometimes there's a couple of them. So
yes.
So I assume Randall Whitfield is going to come up, and there's so many obscure details that I'm excited to talk about that, you know. I guess he had the strip of athletic tape across his nose, which is one of his most memorable disguises, which mm-hmm. is odd, but you know, there's little things, but just the fact that he was driving around in a 1974 Champagne Edition gold Volkswagen Beetle. And as I kind of started comparing his stuff to Ted Bundy, I'm like, wow, there are a lot of overlaps here. And I often wonder how much was Ted Bundy an influence, because obviously, when this guy was growing up, Ted Bundy's case was all over the news. And
yeah.
If he was already had a propensity for sexual assault and being violent to women, and then all of a sudden you see this guy who's kind of like the god of that version of men, you know, it's like, whoa, and he's getting all this attention. And now he's driving a Volkswagen Beetle. So I just wonder, you know, I do wonder about that. I do wonder, like, how much, because it is amazing how narrative contagion works. And how people, and I actually think this also comes back to the concept of psychopathy, how people then, you know, they'll see Silence of the Lambs and they'll think, ah, that's what a psychopath looks like, not realizing that Anthony Hopkins, you know, just kind of created that version of his, what he would think a psychopath. And he actually took the voice he used as Hannibal Lecter. He took that from, I don't know if you've seen 2001, Stanley Kubrick's 2001, but at the end of the movie, there's this computer named Hal, who is kind of an evil computer who decides he's going to just like kind of murder these guys. And the voice is just, it's eerily emotionless. There's nothing to it. And so Anthony Hopkins just felt like that's how a psychopath sounds. And then of course, now everybody thinks that that's what, so I guess my point is, like, is what we, and then however they portrayed Bundy, even though Bundy, you know, did not come from a normal childhood, and I go very deeply into his childhood to just really point out, like, you think he had a normal childhood? Let me tell you. But a lot of people think, well, he's just a psychopath. He had a perfectly fine childhood. And then, you know, something like that then gets imprinted in the mind of somebody maybe like Randall Whitfield, who identifies and then just starts copying. So that's the narrative contagion, because it's almost sometimes like the media teaches us, if we're kind of, we have a propensity for violence, like how to, you know, write our own story about who we're going to be in the world. And, mm-hmm. and it often looks like, you know, copycat killings. I mean, Columbine is a perfect example of this.
You know, it's fascinating. I'm really glad you mentioned that there was the meet and greet following the presentation. I forgot about it, so I'm going to be sure and sign up. So I want our listeners to remember that on April 8th at 7:30 p.m., you're doing this presentation at the Cascade Theater. They can go on to www.cascadetheater.org. Theater is T-H-E-A-T-R-E. You need to buy them at the Cascade Theater, and they can do the meet and greet with you.
There's a code and scan, so they can either scan it. It is limited, so you can either scan it. I think it's on the website now, psychologyofserialkillers.com, to scan if they want to pay for the meet and greet. I think that it's like /events after that, and then they can go down and, because I know it's limited, so not everybody can get it. So I would suggest maybe getting it in advance, but if they don't, and then they get to the Cascade Theater, we're going to have QR codes on screen. So if there's still some available, they can scan there.
Excellent. Sounds wonderful. You know, I find it fascinating that these individuals can do repeated acts of violence, extreme violence, and then they move through life undetected.
Not only undetected, yeah. But acting like if nothing's happened.
I mean, how does that work?
that's I think one of the reasons why so many of us are so fascinated by serial killers. Especially, and when I say so many of us, most people who are really interested in true crime are women. I would say that around 85 to 90% of the people that come to my shows are women. So that's a hint for you men out there. If you want to find a date, they're going to be at my shows because that's where they all go. They're not going to probably trust you if you're a heterosexual dude showing up by yourself at the show. Because most of the time it's either a husband who's buying tickets for his wife to make her happy because she really likes true crime. Yes, men, there are plenty of men that like this stuff. It's just way more women who are into this stuff. And so to get back to your question about, so I think that it's the idea of how does a person do this? And the reason why I think so many women are drawn to this is because it's so less likely that women would be not only murdering like this, but then going on with their lives like this. You know, usually, first of all, only 7 to 8% of all serial killers are female. And of that 7%, over 1/3 of them have a male accomplice.
Oh.
And here's another interesting fact is that basically one of the only times we've ever seen a female be sadistic in her kills is if she has a male accomplice. When women kill, they're pretty pragmatic about it. It's kind of like real quick, real, let's just get this over with. Mm-hmm. They're not about the sadism, the playing around with the bodies, certainly not necrophilia. Like women are not into that stuff. Men are interested in all that stuff. Some of them, obviously plenty of serial killers aren't into that stuff, but some of them are very much into that stuff. And so if you've got a killer couple, if a female of the killer couple is sadistic in her kills, she's sadistic because it gets him off, not because she's into it. It just, she wants to turn her partner on. And so that's where we see it. So again, I know I'm kind of going off on these little tangents, but I will get back to this concept of like, okay, so obviously one of the things that intrigues us when it comes to how it is that a human being, and most of them are men, who could just kill multiple times and then go on with their lives and sometimes have wives and children and love their wives and children and yet are able to go out in the night undetected by their families and just murder. And a lot of times they'll be sex workers or people that won't be picked up by society because sex workers are just seen as less human because they're worth less to our society, which is incredibly unfortunate.
Yeah,
it's another reason we don't actually see a lot of black serial killers in the news. It's not because there are a lack of them. It's because most black serial killers will go after black victims and black victims don't make the news. So
that's
just
sad.
Like, these are the it's horribly sad. So, but these are the things. So that's why people are like, oh, they're all white males. Like, no, but here's what our media tends to be drawn to: white and you know, pretty blondes who get murdered and whatever. So this is who come from good homes, you know, not sex workers. Sex workers are just tossed aside. So here's the thing: how does somebody do that? How do they compartment? It does come down to compartmentalization. And so, what do I mean by that? It just basically means that human beings, all human beings, not just men, human beings all know how to compartmentalize if they can justify it. And if they've just find a way to kind of turn a blind eye to certain things. Now, here's an example of that, because, and then we'll get back to men who can, you know, have wives and children. And then
yes.
So here's an example that, and again, this is not a judgment. I'm not judging anyone who does this, but this is just to kind of put in perspective. So when I do my shows, I talk a lot about things that, you know, especially when they're children, they sometimes get into, like animal cruelty. And people get very upset, obviously, about animal cruelty in the same way that if you hear a child getting hurt, it's like, oh, how dare they? But animal cruelty is a big one that really gets people up in arms about things, because they're like, this is the worst. So you've got people who are very upset by animal cruelty, but they are the same people. So they love their dogs and their cats, but they have no problems going to a restaurant and ordering a steak or a burger. And they have no need to know where that animal came from or what that animal was treated like, because society has taught them that that's perfectly acceptable, that we don't need to really think about how much pain and torture these cows and pigs are actually going through. I always say I triple dog dare you to watch Farm to Fridge on YouTube. I can't get through it. It just kind of really shows you what these slaughterhouses are really, what's going on here. But we don't, you know, if you eat meat, you're not interested in that. You're not interested in ever hurting your dog or your cat, but you certainly don't want to know what goes on in the slaughterhouses.
Yes.
And so, because the thing is, you've turned a blind eye to it. You've compartmentalized because society has told you, that's fine. In the same way, society's told us that sex workers are just less, you know, what, like we've learned a lot of things. And so I think the point is that now if we look at the full spectrum of extreme behavior, in a similar way, a man who is able to love his child and love his wife, and yes, believe it or not, they are attached to these family members of theirs, they have no problems going out and killing a sex worker, because a sex worker, in the same way a steak is to a human, they're kind of like just an object for the pleasure. It's like, wow, they're not really human, an object for my pleasure. They're able to compartmentalize it. So, you know, it's just being able to understand that all humans have the ability to compartmentalize. Again, another horrible example is you look at something like what happened in Nazi Germany. You've got all of these people that suddenly decided that there's a whole other group of people that just aren't really human. And these men, and women, some of them women who were Nazis, were able to love their families and treat their families perfectly fine. And then they had no problems loading innocent children and people onto trains and shooting them in fields and just allow, you know. And we know that there's plenty of studies showing that many of them didn't have to do it. A lot of them ended up doing it for camaraderie. So it's because, well, these are just people to kind of get rid of because they're not really human. So humans are able to do this. And that's my point. It's not.
Wow.
And that's why my point is beware and be aware, because, you know, we're very good as humans at accusing other people of having no empathy, but we're not great at looking at the lack of empathy we feel for those that we accuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we as humans have got to get better at looking at ourselves. And again, I understand that most of us don't want to murder and most of us don't want to hurt people. And that's wonderful. And again, we got really lucky for being in that group. But my point is that a lot of humans aren't very lucky and they are mentally ill. And so I think we need to be a little more curious and have a little more compassion. And I think that, and again, no excuse for this violence, but I do think that being somebody who can say, well, I'm not that person, I don't understand how a person can get there, but maybe just having a little more curiosity about how it happens. Because again, it's that curiosity that can help us when it comes to prevention, because then we can ideally get to the bottom of how these things happen.
Yes. You know, something you mentioned about white serial killers versus black. So does it go across the spectrum for many cultures, or is it predominantly white?
Okay, so most people, if they are a serial killer, they tend to stay in their own race.
That's interesting.
They tend to kill in their own race. But of course, there are plenty of examples where that's not the case. Like, for example, if men are targeting sex workers, they just want to kill sex workers, and oftentimes doesn't matter if you're black, white, Hispanic, whatever, they're just targeting because, you know, maybe like, you know, in the case of the alleged Gilgo Beach killer, Rex Huerman, you know, they found notes in his house that was kind of like they need to have small bodies. But many people speculate that that's because they're just easier to dispose of.
Yes.
It's just easier because dead weight is heavy.
Yeah. And control to get to complete their
Absolutely.
Crime. Yes. This is a segment of Enjoy Exceptional Living. I am Lynn Fritz, your program producer and host. Our guest today is Dr. Rachel Tolles, psychologist who is speaking on the topic at the Cascade Theater of the psychology of serial killers. Do you think that the early years of serial killers, childhood, or what frame, time frame, do you see these behaviors, or can you see the behaviors developing?
I mean, yes. So,
you mentioned animal, killing animals.
Well, yes. So no, that's something that I think is important because, okay, so there's something called the McDonald Triad, which many people who are really into this stuff, they'll know exactly what that is. But the McDonald Triad, it was a theory that came out a while back. And the idea was, well, we'll be able to tell if a kid's going to be a psychopath or a killer in the future. He's more likely if he maybe has these three things. And the three things were cruelty to animals, or, you know, killing animals, lighting fires, and wetting the bed. Now, here's where it gets tricky to me. Boys and girls are very different. Now, obviously, some of that is socialization and some of that is biology. And what we know is that boys and are very, they respond very differently to trauma in their environments and things that they're experiencing. And so do girls. So whereas girls, if they're experiencing things like sexual abuse and physical abuse and neglect and various things, they are far more likely to turn it on themselves, meaning they're more likely to cut themselves, develop eating disorders, maybe get into dangerous sex work, things like that, versus boys. They are more likely, way more likely, to externalize their trauma, which means that if something is going wrong at home and there are major boundary violations occurring, which in every single serial killer's life, I have found major boundary violations occurring, they are more likely, especially like bedwetting is one of the, you know, it's not always, of course, a sign that they're being sexually abused, but it's often a sign that there could be sexual abuse happening in a house. So bedwetting, and then you've got fire setting, which is destructive behavior that's externalized. And then, of course, cruelty to animals, which is basically a child attacking something smaller than themselves, but it implies that there's something bigger that's attacking them. So they're acting out, they're externalizing their trauma in a way that maybe the girl, we just don't see it as much in girls. And so hence, you know, males are more likely to be predators and females are far more likely to be prey. So to answer your question, warning signs, yes, of course you can say cruelty to animals is something that is absolutely a warning sign. But it happens so much earlier. I mean, the most important years in a child's development happen between 0 and 3. And this is what's called a critical period. And it starts in utero when the child is a fetus. And what we now know is that if a mother, while pregnant, is ingesting teratogens, which are toxins, so like alcohol, drugs, pills, cannabis, nicotine, a lot of these toxins, and that combined with a very stressful pregnancy, that combination is shown to be connected to violent behavior later on. And that's just one of the factors that kind of stack over and over and over again. So you've got that, and serial killers have that across the board in their histories. And then you've got when the first 33 months out of the womb, that is the other very critical period. That's when a child should ideally develop a secure attachment versus a fractured attachment. And during this time, a child should develop a sense of omnipotence, which is the feeling of being all powerful like God. Now, how a child develops this is that they have a need, and the entire world, which is their mother, consistently responds. Now, if a baby has a need, and maybe mom shows up, maybe she doesn't, or if mom is so smothering or so abusive or controlling that the baby has no ability to have any space between itself and the mother to even know what its needs are, the baby will withdraw in on itself and become hardwired to feel powerless. And so, across the board, we see with these people that serial killers' mothers certainly are either neglectful, inconsistent in their care, or extremely dominant, abusive, extremely smothering. A lot of times what they call emotional incest is very common, or a very confusing combination of these things. So we're talking, so when you say warning signs, well, that's unfortunately, like, a lot of times this is behind closed doors.
Yes.
And people aren't able to really see, but these early years. But the plus side is that we know that if we are able to intervene when they're juveniles, because then there's all these other stacking things that I talk about that lead up to the hormones kicking in, we can turn it around. And I want to get to another thing that you asked, because you did ask a question I don't feel like I fully answered, which is there a chance that some of these guys can turn it around? Well, what we know is, look, and I'm not ever suggesting that we release serial killers from prison, because I actually think that it's way more of a risk than... And anything, I do think we need to be treating prisoners all around way more humanely. And we can talk about recidivism rates in Norway and all that kind of stuff. But mm-hmm. what we know when it comes to people who murder, we know that by the time they're in their late 30s, early 40s, their desire to be violent in this way, if they've been incarcerated, goes way down. And we see this across the board with many studies. And there's reasons for this. For one, oftentimes when they are incarcerated, usually maybe let's say they're incarcerated by 25, 30, now they've had several years in prison where for the first time in their lives, they have structure and consistency, which is something they've desperately needed their whole lives and they haven't had. And they're developing real relationships with people, oftentimes prison guards or maybe, you know, other inmates, but they're developing genuine relationships that are starting to feel like there's real connection. And all humans at the end of the day deeply just need and want connection. And then, of course, at that age, we know the hormones are dissipating. So, yeah. You know, the hormones are a big one. By age 40, you know, men, they're a lot less likely. We know with erections and stuff, they're losing them at that age. They're just not as driven sexually. It doesn't mean that they still don't have them. But we know that even without treatment, these people are just their desire to be violent and do these things just naturally goes down around that age. So whether or not, you know, they could ever be rehabilitated, I mean, that obviously remains to be seen. But yeah, I just went off on a tangent, but I realized I didn't answer fully that question you asked. So
I think it's fascinating, though, what you're sharing. And if we had the capacity, when we see the patterns of fires and animal torture or harm to animals, when you think of intervention, what are you pointing to? What would be some of the tools that would be used for an intervention?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, right now, what I think we actually are in way more of a crisis with is mass shooting. Mass shootings are way more of a problem than serial killing, because serial killing has gone way down. The peak of serial killing was anywhere between 1981 and 1987, and then it's just kind of gone down. And one of the reasons it's gone down significantly is obviously because of DNA testing started to kind of have an uptick in the late 80s. And then so we have the DNA, and then, of course, we also have surveillance everywhere. And there's a lot of reasons now with the cell phone thing. You know, Brian Koberger is a perfect example. I think that if he'd killed back in the, you know, 70s or 80s, he probably wouldn't have gotten caught and he would have continued killing. Mm-hmm. But luckily, we have all of these wonderful devices and things we can do now. But I do think that mass shooters are our biggest... what we should be examining. And so one of the ways, because again, there's so much going on behind closed doors that we don't see. When I read interviews of neighbors of serial killers or mass shooters, those are often the ones they'll say, yeah, things weren't okay. We were the ones that were hearing it on a regular basis. We'd see the kids locked out of the house without any clothes on or whatever the thing is, the mother being drunk all the time or whatever it is. And so when it comes to mass shooters, obviously, we've heard plenty of cases where the teachers or the administrators are kind of saying, hey, there's something wrong with this kid. And the families of mass shooters are, you know, notorious for not really being great when it comes to accountability. They'll say, well, not my kid. Why are you going after my kid? Hmm. And like the Crumley case, I think, was the first case where the parents were held responsible, you know, which I think is great. I think we have to hold the parents responsible because, you know, the teacher said he's drawing pictures of guys. He's basically threatening to kill people. And the parents said, it's fine. And then he was sent back to school and he shot up the school. So,
yeah.
One of the intervention things I would say that we need, because I think that teachers are one of the most important. They're one of the most, it's the most, I'd say one of the top most important jobs anyone could have on this planet. And I think they are paid peanuts.
Yes.
I don't think we treat teachers nearly as we need to be treating teachers like we treat CEOs. Okay. And then the other way, like we should flip it. Cause like teachers, they're the second tier. They're the second set of eyes. They see everything. I can't tell you the number of people who would have gone on to do violent things had they not had that one teacher. They'll say, I had that one teacher. She just saw me and she just wouldn't let up. And she just kept showing up and showing up.
Yeah.
And, you know, because it only takes that one person, because, you know, your family system is what you got, but you have that second chance when you go to school to have that next set of eyes to say, hey, you do matter. You are important. And that's where teachers come in. And so teachers will see way more than what anyone else sees, especially if they work with kids, they're able to know this one's a bit off. And so one of my proposals is, look, if you're going to have your kid enrolled in a school, private or public, the price of admission needs to be that you sign off a waiver that states that if a teacher or administrator, there are flags and they can sense something's very off about your kid, you can put them into a mandated psych eval. Because if you intervene early, because those kids are ready to talk, or they're ready to at least answer questions on a test that maybe won't be so obvious, because a lot of kids might be afraid, they don't want to get their families in trouble, but they'll mm-hmm. be able to answer questions about their emotional states that no one's really asking. And I think that a mandated psych eval for kids where the teachers and the administrators are able to see something's going on, because the parents will keep saying, nothing's wrong with my kid, you're attacking my kid. And that's the problem. If they're from a family system where it's all about no accountability and externalizing blame, which a lot of these families have, then the kid's being taught that, oh yeah, you externalize your blame and that's where the bullets go. And so that's where we can't rely on the parents saying the kid's fine if we know that, you know, there are plenty of kids that aren't fine. And, you know, it's not like parents are given a teaching manual before they have kids on how to be a good parent. So,
yeah.
And they come from lineages themselves where they didn't maybe learn it. And so, again, this isn't to throw parents under the bus, but it's just to say, well, how do we intervene when things are going wrong and the parents maybe don't have the tools? Well, this is one way. So that's one way I would say that we definitely need to change things in our society.
Yeah, I think what you're pointing to, I think, is imperative, because we see that violence in our schools and in our communities, and you know something's going on. So to be able to respond and intervene and change the trajectory would be amazing to be able to accomplish that.
Yes, and I think it needs to be mandated. And if you want to homeschool your kid, fine. And then maybe, you know, unfortunately, maybe he'll shoot up you. But like when you're allowing a kid to come into a school system, and that is a liability. And if the parents didn't really have the tools because they didn't come from good families themselves, like they didn't know, like then the kid is in a place where he's just kind of, or he or she is desperate to get someone else. And if the parents just keep denying, and then the kid shoot, you know, that's why it's like, well, we can't rely. If the kid is mentally ill for various reasons and struggling with mental illness, we need to have these things in place so that, because again, when you intervene early, like 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, when they're juveniles,
yes,
this is where we can turn it around. But the only way to do that is if we can mandate eval, because these evals are incredible and they will show immediately what's going on with the kid. And then ideally the kid can get help with people outside of the family, like group therapy and whatnot.
Do you know of any particular organization that provides the type of assessment you're pointing to for teachers to access or professionals?
Well, this is where I think there's legalities, and because the teachers, their hands are tied, because
yes,
there's only so much they can do. And so right now we don't have anything that would allow for this to happen. And that's why I think that it should be a national, I mean, it's very unlikely
program
that it would spread nationally, but it should be something that we start implementing in all school systems. Because again, if you're, you know, you've got kids that are coming to school, you don't know what the ticking time bomb is going on at home. And it is, you know, so we do need that. I mean, I worked at the Rice Davis Child Testing Center when I was in California, doing my grad school work, and that's a testing center, but you sometimes need, you know, for that, you need a good insurance. You need you need different things that would allow for you to get your, because it's really expensive to test your kid. That's the other thing. So
yes.
Some of our money does need to go into taking care of our people. And this is one of the ways, because otherwise we're just going to keep seeing, you know, these mass shootings and mass casualties. And it's really, you know, we need to be taking care of our people on so many levels. I mean, this is obviously just one small, you know, place, but this is where I'm obviously directing my focus. But yes, we need to be taking care of our people in this country.
Yes.
And this is one way.
Personally, I think it's the only way we're going to turn it around is if we can intervene and provide this support, because like you say, it's costly and many parents don't have the income to be able to do that. But if it was part of the way of working with the system within the schools, it would be powerful to create change.
Exactly. You got it. And that's it. And that's something that when I get a chance to really get up on a soapbox, I'm going to be spewing that. Again and again and again and again, every time I can, it's like, this is the change we need. We need to be doing this. It should not even be a question. We need to be funding this.
This is a segment of Enjoy Exceptional Living. I am Lynn Fritz, your program producer and host. Our guest today is Dr. Rachel Tolles, psychologist who is speaking on the topic at the Cascade Theater of The Psychology of Serial Killers.
Guns, we're never gonna get rid of them in this country, and you know, just like we won't get rid of football, but I think we should have gun laws. For example, why is it that we can't rent a car till we're 25, but while our brain is still developing, we can own a gun? Like that, you know, a
good
brain
point.
Developing. Really, why is this not a law? Like, there should be a law. If you can't rent a car at 25, you probably shouldn't be able to own a gun at 25. Okay, until 25, you should own. Like, that's the age when, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, if you know, there are all sorts of things. People are like, well, I want to teach my son how to shoot. It's like, okay, but they shouldn't have access and they shouldn't be able to own them, period. They shouldn't be able to buy them. Because your brain, when it's developing at that age, you're all over the place. And so, you know, Columbine.
Yes.
I mentioned, Columbine's a really important. It's one of those things where it's really unfortunate that we have not had any other movie about Columbine aside from Bowling for Columbine, which you know, I love Michael Moore, and he's got good stuff to say about gun control, but the movie basically didn't cover what possibly should have been covered, or really, in my opinion, should have been covered. And there's a book that came out called Columbine, which I am not a fan of, because so those were the two kind of narratives that came out after Columbine, and they didn't help matters. The book, the reason why I'm not a fan of the book is because Dave Cullen, who's a journalist, he's not a psychologist, was somebody who wrote about how one of the perpetrators, Eric Harris, was the psychopath, and the other one, Dylan Klebold, was the depressive. And so, first of all, and I understand he was basing, you know, his research about calling Eric Harris a psychopath on the fact that psychologists apparently said it, but they were basing their conclusions about this kid on his diaries, which he was writing, you know, at age 16. Now, if you look back at your diaries when you were 16, everyone at that age would come across like they had a personality disorder, because the world, when your brain is still developing, is very black and white. You've got journal entries that are like, if he doesn't love me back, I'm going to kill myself. I mean, there's so much extreme, language when you're at that age, because your brain is developing and everything is very black and white, all or nothing thinking. That's just what it is at that age. And if you actually look at, and I've read Eric Harris's diaries as well as Dylan Klebold's, like, he was also saying we should give the earth back to the animals because they deserve it infinitely more than we do. And if that a true psychopath isn't thinking about animals and deeply loved his animals. So the point is that, okay, so if Eric Harris was really the problem, as it seemed like Dave Cullen wanted to point out, then why is it that every subsequent shooter after Columbine had the depressive, it was exact prototype of Dylan Klebold, the one that he said was just the depressive follower. They all wound up looking like that depressive follower. That is how Dylan Klebold was categorized. He was a depressive follower. Well, why is it that every subsequent shooter has more of the makeup of how you would describe a Dylan Klebold as the depressant? I mean, no one after Columbine, for the most part, they're not described as psychopathic people that have no, it's like, these are kids that are across the board were bullied. And again, this is not to excuse, but it's really, you know, when I really started delving into what actually happened at Columbine, a lot of this just got, people just kind of brushed off what was actually going on. And I think that then, of course, going back to the idea of narrative contagion, then you've got, that's exactly what happened. You have a bunch of kids who now see this new type that they can look up to, which is the anti-hero. Mm-hmm. Because before Columbine, you know, think about what was going on. You would have these movies like Say Anything and The Breakfast Club. And you'd have these guys that were kind of outsider types that were wearing trench coats, but they were cool. And then you've got these guys that are coming in with trench coats and shooting up the school. And suddenly trench coats are a no-no, because it's like, this is, but these kids are latching onto this concept of the anti-hero versus what used to be, which was maybe a serial killer. It was a different type of, thing that the narrative contagion was, but people were like, oh, I want to be like that. Because so many people copycatted serial killers. They just do, because they're like, I want to be like that. I want to get attention. And before serial killers, of course, assassinations were really big. Assassinations. And so you talk to people who would assassinate people, and they'd say, I wanted to be somebody. And because they knew that I'm going to assassinate John Lennon, and my name's going to be forever attached to John mm-hmm. Lennon, you know? So it's just, so in a similar way. And so now you've got the anti-hero, and that became the narrative contagion. It's kind of this idea that, like, okay, well, in a world where if you're not special, if you're not accomplished, you're nothing. It's all or nothing. We live in a very all or nothing society. There's this idea that, but if I do something spectacular, a spectacular violent act, I can for a moment be somebody. Because every one of these kids, before they do this, are suicidal. They've all contemplated suicide. They think, I just want to end my life. Mm-hmm. So again, going back to the idea of intervention, that's a huge flag if they're thinking they want to end it, because then they have nothing to lose. And then they decide, well, if I'm going to end it anyway, I may as well not just disappear. I may as well become very visible, which is what these other people did. And at least I'll be making a statement, because a lot of them have just felt invisible their whole life. So they're like, why do I just want to end my life in an invisible way when I can be very visible for a brief moment of time and maybe be somebody? And it's really sad, but this is what happened after Columbine. This is what the message was, that you could, anybody could be somebody if they just, you know, decide to do something violent and horrific.
Outrageous. Do you think it's more of a problem in the U.S. than in other countries?
Yeah, I do. I think there's no question. And here's, I mean, you just have to look at statistics. Mm-hmm. So 65% of all serial killers are from the United States. 65% of all serial killers are from the United States. And the second highest country, coming in at number two for the most serial killers, is England. Wow. And they come in at 3.4%.
Wow.
So you got to, you know, so obviously something's going on here. And there's a lot of reasons why. I mean, we have a very spread out country, which makes it very easy to cross state lines and to, you know, to do certain things. You can get away with, like, if you live in, you know, smaller cities in Europe, more people know you, and it's just more difficult. But I don't think that's obviously just one factor. There's a lot more going on. And it's a very complicated answer as to why. But yes, and then of course the mass shootings are just—it's the numbers are ridiculous. That it's a U.S. problem. We're not seeing mass shootings happening in other places like this.
Do you think when we talk about guns, it would be different? I don't think we'll ever not have guns in the U.S. But do you think if we banned and gathered up the assault rifles, that would make a difference?
Absolutely. I mean, yes, I would say my opinion, And I joke when I go to the Texas shows, I always say, look, I know I'm not allowed to talk about guns here because you guys like your guns, but they'll laugh because they know, like, yes, we love our guns. And so, but yeah, I mean, if you were to ask me, I don't think we should have guns. I don't like them. And that's an unpopular opinion for many, but I don't like them. I'm from Canada originally, and we obviously have guns in Canada, but we don't have this kind of problem. But yes, the assault rifles, they need to go. Like, these, it's ridiculous. Why do we have them? It's just, why? Yeah, I could go on. But yes, I think those need to go. So if it were up to me, let's just say we had to keep the guns. Which I think we're going to keep the guns here in this country. So we need to have laws, and one of the laws should be, yes, get rid of the assault rifles. And number two, I think, like I said earlier, there needs to be an age that a person, once their brain is fully developed, like let's say 26, then, and also a mental, you take a mental health and mental eval before you can own a gun. Like, these things should be in place.
The norms.
If you're going to own a gun, we need to be more responsible about this.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly. We only have a couple minutes left, so I wanted to give you the opportunity, just taking a couple minutes to, is there anything else you want to communicate to our listeners besides, be sure and don't miss the April 8th, 7:30 p.m. at the Cascade Theater where you're doing a presentation. What else would you share?
Well, this is a very sweet question. Thank you for, you know, I wasn't prepared for it to be kind of an open, but I will say, look, if you're interested in true crime, that's okay. Like, a lot of people wonder, is there something about me that's weird because I like this stuff? Like, what is it about me? And it's like, we're all just human, and we're all just curious about humans. And yeah, some of us are just afraid because we know we're way more likely to be the prey versus the predators. Some of us are just into really dark things. And so it's about just being a human. The more you can focus on awareness of who you are, and acceptance of that, and which means it's self-love. And so, you know, the better, meaning have curiosity about yourself, because I do know that when people are afraid of their own shadows, they're way more likely to attack the shadows within others. And so just befriend your own shadow. Don't make an enemy out of it. It's not because I'm not saying, okay, well, if you befriend your own shadow, you can go out and kill. It's like, no, because if you befriend your people who are more accepting of their own darkness are way less likely to do harmful things than people that are cut off from that awareness. You know, you don't have the awareness. People will say, oh, so you think that if someone like Hitler was just aware and just accepted, it's like, if Hitler had awareness, he wouldn't have done what he did. He didn't have, like, these people lack the awareness. So it's about befriend yourself, befriend even the parts of yourself that you might think are icky and gross and scary. It's like, just learn how to sit with them and be curious about them, and maybe be the parent that maybe you didn't have to start loving those parts of yourself. Because I do think that if we can get curious and accepting about our own strangeness as humans, we're more likely to be compassionate and curious about others. And I think this world at this stage needs nothing more than love and compassion and curiosity. And I think we need it more than ever is what I mean. I think we need community. That's the other thing. I guess that's the other thing I should say, is that people ask me all the time, like, why do we have such a mental health crisis in this country? It's like, because we lack community more than ever before. I mean, there was a time where, you know, you'd go to a grocery store and you'd know the clerk's name, and you'd know that they had kids, and you'd ask them how their family was, and you'd have an interaction. And now, you know, basically not even looking them in the eye or quick to get your money, but you just want to get out the door. Now these people are being replaced by machines anyway. But it's like, we are more than ever lacking connection and community. And I think more than ever, we need it. And so it's about learning how to slow down. So not just that relationship with yourself, but slowing down and taking in the people around you, because you never know if, you know, the one thing you could say that's kind to a person is the one thing that saves their life.
Purpose of this program is to invite people to engage in community. I want to thank Dr. Rachel Tolles, psychologist. She is going to be at the Cascade Theater April 8th, 7:30 p.m. The presentation is called The Psychology of Serial Killers. Do not miss this unique opportunity. I want to thank you very much for joining us and sharing your expertise, your insight, your wisdom. And obviously you have a passion for your field and making a difference.
Well, thank you, Lynn, so much for having me. This has been such a pleasure. You've been such an incredible host, and you've got these great questions, and I can sense them landing in you and that you care deeply. So this has been a real pleasure to chat with you. So thank you for having me.
Thank you.